The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library and to the 5th Annual Philadelphia Book Festival. My name is Irv Randolph. I'm the managing editor of the Philadelphia Tribune and a proud supporter of the Free Library. The six-day book festival is packed with author events, musical performances, interactive workshops, and more. The book festival culminates this Saturday, April 16th, at the Lively Outdoor Street Fair, featuring more than 80 literary exhibitors and even more free, family-friendly programs and events in and around Parkway Central. Each day of the festival promises something for everyone, and I hope that tonight is just one of many visits you'll be making to the Free Library this week. Be sure to pick up a festival guide from the table outside the auditorium for a complete schedule of events. I would like to also take a moment to recognize festival sponsors Ruth Ann A. Morris Williams, Jr., and Scraddy Ronan Stevens and Young, whose generosity has made the Philadelphia Book Festival possible. It is now my honor to introduce Donald Bogle, the country's leading scholar of African Americans in film, and coincidentally, the brother of Robert Bogle, president and CEO of the Philadelphia Tribune, the nation's oldest and greater Philadelphia region's largest newspaper serving the African American community. Donald Bogle grew up in Yaden, in Yaden, PA, and as a child, he spent a lot of time watching television and going to the movies. He grew up wondering why there are very few African-American characters. Donald Bogle teaches at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts and at the University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of several critically acclaimed books, including Dorothy Dandridge, Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks, Primetime Blues, and Bright Boulevard's Bold Dreams. In his new book, Heat Wave, Donald Bogle traces screen star Ethel Waters' life from her childhood years of poverty in Chester, PA, to her success in Hollywood, where she became the second African-American ever to be nominated for an Academy Award. Bogle recounts with detail her stint in black vaudeville, her turbulent personal life, and her hard-won success as a Broadway musical comedy and dramatic star. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Donald Bogle.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What we're going to do tonight is that we're going to start in an unusual way. What we're going to do is that I'm going to show you a film clip from a movie that Ethel Waters appeared in. This is a movie that was released in 1943. It was an all-black film that was produced at MGM Studios. MGM was the most powerful of the Hollywood studios. It was directed by Vincent Minnelli, and it had an all-star cast. Leading that cast, of course, was the incomparable Ethel Waters. Also in the movie, though, there was Eddie Rochester Anderson. There was Lena Horne. There was Duke Ellington. There was Louis Armstrong. There was Mantan Moreland. There was Willie Best. There was Rex Ingram. And there also in the film, there was Ruby Dandridge, the mother of Dorothy. Now, Cabin in the Sky deals with a very pious woman, played by Ethel Waters, who's married to a man who has a roving eye. That man is Eddie Rochester Anderson, and his roving eye mostly likes to rove all over Lena Horne. It's a musical fantasy, and at the climax of the film, which we're going to take a look at in a minute, we're going to see Ethel Waters when she confronts her husband, played by Rochester, and the woman he's been running around with, Lena Horne. We want to note Ethel Waters' attitude in this film. Her character is a very pious one, but she's all glammed up in this sequence as she fights to get her husband back. One other thing I should tell you as you watch this sequence, and you see the subtext that's here. And that is that, quite simply, Ethel Waters did not like Lena Horne. In fact, she detested her. So we want to watch the fireworks as they take off between these two women. We're going to look at this clip. It's going to run about 8 or 9 minutes, and I'll come back and tell you more about Ethel. And the thing we also want to remember is that this movie comes midway in Ethel Waters' career. So without further ado, we're going to look at that clip from Vincent Minnelli's Cabin in the Sky.
Domino!
Hello, little Joe. How you doing these days?
I'm still alive and kicking. That ain't no fault of yours.
Still cheating the boys with those one-way knives of yours?
Cut that stuff out.
George, what are you doing hanging around with a small fry like that?
Better than hanging around with a tin-horn gambler like you.
I won't take that from you.
Look out, baby. I'll go after you again.
That's all right. Let him. Only this time I ain't running, see?
Come on, boys. Break it up now. This is a social gathering. You trying to get back in that deal again?
Good evening, Rip Rand. Hello, Jim Henry. Thought I'd just drop around and give you a joint the once over.
Petunia, is this really you?
Oh, but not the same me you used to break our back busting suds over a tub for you.
Why, you're beautiful, Petunia.
Oh, save that sugarcoat talk for your girlfriend.
Where'd you get the clothes?
Don't you worry about that, Pops. The main point is you paying for them.
Of course I'll pay for them. I didn't realize.
And that ain't all I'm collecting before I'm through.
Don't talk like that, Petunia. You know I still love you.
Now, you just be a little more careful what you say to your wife in front of me.
George, you keep out of this.
I'm speaking my mind.
And I ain't heard a sound.
Now, little George, you just think dumb. You can't see what she's after.
We're both after the same thing, but I'm still the wife. Is that the inside track?
Junior, don't talk like that. Well, I was coming around to see
don't
you.
Don't strain yourself. I'm sending my lawyer around to see you, and he better find you in.
What for?
Money, what you think? If you ain't saved my hair, brother, stop sprouting wings.
What's wings?
That's one way of getting out of jail. I know all about that sweepstake money, and I'm solid collecting my hair cash on the line.
But I don't know if I got that much left, Petunia.
No? Then you're just in the correct suit to be laid out in. I'll shoot you for a drink, Jim Henry, with your own dice again.
Oh, no. My little Jimmy is going to pass up the formalities. What will it be, Miss Jackson?
You may give me a double king card.
Boy, coming up.
Pardon me, but ain't you the gentleman that used my ex-husband for target practice 6 months ago?
Yes, I had that pleasure.
Then permit me to buy you a drink for that good deed.
Oh, no, ma'am. The drink is on me.
You know, Mr. Johnson, I usually don't drink with strangers, but we have so much in common, we both dislike the same people. Brown! Ain't about time for you to get into that cooch dance?
Lady! Georgia, remember, when you're in the presence of a lady, you gotta act like one.
I guess she's just jealous because she ain't got what I got.
Quit kidding yourself. Not only have I got everything you got, but a whole lot more.
You ain't got little joke.
And that's the main thing you got I don't want. And if I run across any more secondhand junk, I'll pass that on to you.
Junior, you can't act like this.
Oh, can I? Why, Jim Henry, I see you've worked yourself up with an orchestra.
Yeah.
Ask the boys to put me in the mood so I can give out.
With pleasure, Miss Jackson.
Suddenly feel a musical urge. Little Jackson, to your musical urge.
Muscles on every beat. All that money much fire period is up tonight, have you? In fact, I think he has just 10 minutes left.
That's a lot of time when we're on the job.
And it looks like he's not coming down there alone. Well, it looks like he's going to bring Petunia right on down there with him.
Okay, that was, of course, Cabin in the Sky, as I mentioned. It comes out in 1943. And this movie really comes midway in Ethel Waters' career. It's almost unbelievable to think of the things that she had done before this film, which was very, very important to Ethel Waters, and which was also a very difficult movie for her to make. Now, before this film, Ethel Waters had already had really an amazing set of achievements. She had already had these great triumphs. She had really had groundbreaking accomplishments, especially for an African-American woman. Now, the interesting thing about Ethel Waters, when we think about her and when we look back at her early life, at her background, Ethel Waters, in so many respects, is the last person that anyone would have ever predicted would become a star. Ethel Waters had been born in 1896, at the tail end of the 19th century, when America was quite a different place. Ethel Waters had beaten the odds to become a star. And when we look at her early life, we can see that she even beat the odds simply to survive. Her childhood had been something of a nightmare. Her very birth, her conception, these were circumstances that were hardly pretty. Ethel Waters, the way she tells the story, was the daughter of a young teenager named Louise Anderson. And Louise Anderson, as a teenager, was living with her mother, Sally Harris Anderson, and her two sisters, Vi and Ching, and a brother named Charles. Now, Louise, even as a young girl, was very serious-minded, very, very religious, and she had hopes of one day becoming an evangelist. It didn't work out that way for Louise. One day, when Louise was at home with her sister, the two were alone, a young man came by. His name was John Waters. And unknown to Louise, he had been observing her from afar. In the house, he asked Louise's sister if Louise was yet broke in. In other words, he was asking if Louise was a virgin. He got Louise alone in the house, and then he attacked her sexually. She resisted at one point, and according to Ethel, he pulled a knife on her. He raped Louise, and then he went his way. Afterwards, Louise found herself pregnant, and she was totally bewildered. She didn't understand the changes that were coming about in her body. She didn't understand how this could have happened to her. On October 31st, 1896, in a home in Chester, Pennsylvania, Louise gave birth to a little girl who she named Ethel. Afterwards, Ethel's childhood was just as unhappy, almost, as the circumstances of her birth. Ethel loved her mother Louise deeply, but for Louise, Ethel was a sign of sin, a sign of failure, and Louise could never really show any affection to her daughter. Later, Louise did marry. She had another child, a daughter named Genevieve, who she did show affection and care for. And it made Ethel Waters' childhood all the more difficult. Ethel Waters also found herself often ignored by her two aunts, Louise's sisters. She sometimes found herself mistreated. Ethel Waters had to really grow up on her own, with one exception. In the home, there was one woman who did show her care and concern, and it was her grandmother, Sally Harris Anderson. Sally was disappointed with the way in which her children had turned out, and she had hopes that somehow Ethel's life would be different. Now, Sally Anderson, if we look at her, by outward appearances, she was a very ordinary woman, by outward appearances. Sally worked as a domestic here in Philadelphia at different times in the homes of affluent whites. She sometimes was a cook. She sometimes cleaned. Sometimes she lived in. Other times she was able to have jobs that let her go back to her own home in the evenings. One thing that Sally Anderson did that Ethel never forgot, when Sally was working in the homes of these wealthy whites, she would take the leftovers in the kitchen, things that might later be thrown out. She would delicately wrap them, put them in her pockets, and when she got home, she would take them out and give them to her granddaughter. For Ethel, these were some of the most delightful times she had as a kid. But otherwise, it was a tough growing up experience. The family was very poor. The family moved around. At one point, they were in Chester. Another point, they might be here in Philadelphia. Another time, they might be in Camden, New Jersey. Ethel didn't get a chance of getting much of an education. At one point, her grandmother did put her in a Catholic school. And Ethel always said that it was the Catholic nuns who really did inspire her. And she became deeply religious as a girl. The ironic thing was, as deeply as religious as Ethel was, as a girl growing up in very tough circumstances, Ethel had to toughen herself. At one point, the family was living here in Philadelphia in a red light district. Ethel Waters said that she ran errands for the prostitutes. She was a lookout for the pimps. She also said that throughout her life, she had a certain kind of respect for prostitutes. She felt that there was a certain honesty about them because at least they had no illusions about what it was that they were selling. Ethel Waters also learned to curse like a sailor. She learned to defend her turf. Ethel Waters also said by the age of 7, she knew everything there was to know about sex. Ethel Waters, by the time she was a teenager, she was married. A young man came and asked her mother, Louise, if he could marry her. He had to get her permission. Ethel said that she felt Louise gave permission simply to get her out of the house. Ethel married the young man. The marriage only lasted about a year. And then Ethel Waters was on her own. Ethel Waters' world changed drastically when she was still a teenager, when her beloved grandmother, Sally, took ill, stricken with cancer, and she died. Ethel Waters, for her, this was her greatest heartache. And throughout her life, the two people she cared about the most would be that grandmother who she lost so early and her mother, Louise, who no matter what, she always strove to win Louise's affection. Ethel Waters left school at an early age. She worked as a domestic. She worked at hotels here in Philadelphia as a chambermaid. And she said that sometimes when she was working in the rooms after she had cleaned up those hotel rooms, there would be big mirrors. She would look into the mirrors at herself, and she would imagine herself on a stage, performing for audiences, taking a bow. She had performed in the church, but Ethel Waters had no dreams, really, of becoming an entertainer. This was for her something that wasn't imaginable. The most that she hoped for herself as a girl was that she might be able to work for a wealthy white woman who would travel around the world and take Ethel Waters with her. Ethel Waters continued to work in these domestic jobs. She worked hard, but she also played hard. When she wasn't working, Ethel Waters hit the dance clubs here in Philadelphia. She loved to dance. She could let off steam. She could be herself. She hit the dance halls, the dance clubs, and then one evening, actually on her birthday, October 31st, Ethel Waters was at a club, again here in Philadelphia, and it was sort of an amateur's night, and they were asking people to get up and sing. Ethel Waters got up that night. She sang, and the room turned silent. Though the people in the club couldn't quite define what was so unusual about her, they knew that this was a kind of voice, a kind of style, still evolving, that they had not seen before. There were two men in the club that night, men in show business, men who booked black acts into theaters around the country. At this time in America, there were small black theaters, clubs, where black acts would appear. Later, this whole circuit became known as the Chitlin Circuit. It was black entertainment for black audiences. The two men promised Ethel Waters they could get her work in Baltimore at a theater called the Lincoln. Ethel Waters decided to take the chance. She went with the two men. She performed at the Lincoln in Baltimore. She was a hit. She was going to continue on the road with them. And then one night, she heard the two men talking between themselves about her salary. Ethel Waters had been led to believe she was making $10 a week. In actuality, it was about $25. And the men were skimming the upper part and dividing it between themselves. Well, Ethel Waters soon let the two men know that she had overheard what they were saying. And that tough street girl really laid down the law to them. Ethel Waters, though, continued to entertain. She traveled. And then she came back to Philadelphia after a tour and after an injury. And again, she didn't think of an entertainment career. In Philadelphia, she took a job at the Horn and Hardart Automat. Now, most of you in here are probably too young to know what the Automat was. But the Automat was sort of a restaurant, and there would be little compartments where people might see a sandwich or a slice of pie or a little dessert. And they'd put a nickel or a dime in, and the little door to the compartment would open, and they would have their meal. Ethel Waters cleaned up in the Automat. She worked there, and then came an opportunity for her to go to New York to appear at New York's Lincoln Theater. Ethel Waters once again decided to take the chance, but she was nervous about that job at the Automat, and she asked a friend of hers to please hold on to the job for her in case she had to come back. She got to New York, she played the Lincoln, she was held over, and thus began one of the really great careers of the 20th century. Ethel Waters was a terrific singer. She was also a good dancer, as you saw here in Cabin in the Sky. Even when she's older and she has some weight on her, she can still kick those legs up, and there's still some life in those hips. She was also a talented comedian. Later, she became a powerful dramatic actress. Now, in New York, Ethel Waters, as a young woman, she was slender. She was slinky. And in the very beginning, particularly when she was on the road, she was called Sweet Mama String Bean. And she did sexy bumps and grinds. In New York, she appeared at clubs in Harlem, and then the word went out almost overnight that here was really a great new talent. And Ethel Waters became one of the first black stars appearing in Harlem that whites from downtown rushed uptown to see. In 1921, she signed a record contract with a black company called Black Swan. She traveled on tour for Black Swan, and audiences again were fascinated by her. Later, Black Swan went bankrupt, and Ethel Waters signed with Columbia Records. In the beginning, her records were selling to African-American audiences just about exclusively, and then they began to cross over. Now, Ethel Waters, as a singer, this whole new style on records reached a vast audience. Ethel Waters' two idols were Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey, classic blues singers. And Bessie Smith, who was called the Empress of the Blues, probably was the greatest of all blues singers. Bessie and Ma Rainey, the music came from the gut. The music conveyed them in the grip of a tense emotional experience. Sometimes, particularly with Ma Rainey, people couldn't quite understand what the words were in her music, but it didn't matter because the sounds, the emotion, were so important. Ethel Waters admired these two women, but she knew that their style was not hers. Her style would be quite different. Ethel Waters would convey emotion in her music, but she was always a step removed. The thing about Ethel Waters that distinguished her in the early years, and you can hear it in Cabin in the Sky, was her diction. She had almost just about perfect diction, this bell-like clarity that was to influence later someone like Ella Fitzgerald. Audiences could understand every word that Ethel Waters was saying. Ethel Waters was part blues singer, but not exclusively. And the purists will tell us she really wasn't a blues singer at all. She really, in a way, wasn't a jazz singer, but she mastered melodious pop. She came out with hits. There was a song called Dinah. Nothing could be finer than Dinah. There was a song, Sweet Georgia Brown. Ethel also mastered on records those raunchy songs that had first brought her to prominence. One of her songs was called Shake That Thing. And Ethel let him know she knew how to shake it. Another song was called Brother, You Got Me Wrong, in which she was laying down the law to the brother. Don't take her for granted. Nobody was supposed to, because she wasn't going to take any guff from a guy. Another was called Go Back Where You Stayed Last Night, because mama don't want it in here. Ethel also sang a song called My Handyman, in which she talked about the handyman and all the handy things that he could do for her. Ethel Waters mastered all of these things many years later. She was always religious, but she had her own sense of religion. Many years later, she said that she hated singing these ungodly songs. But if you hear Ethel singing those songs, you know Miss Waters enjoyed every minute of it. The persona that she created in music. In music, she really created a tough girl persona who wouldn't take it. Now, in the 1920s, in the age of the flapper, a time when white women were fighting to get their own independence, Ethel Waters in her music announced, as did Bessie Smith, that she had always had hers. It made her a great symbol for this age. Ethel Waters, also in 1929, went to the West Coast on tour. Now, Hollywood had undergone a great transformation in 1927 when a movie called The Jazz Singer with Al Jolson had appeared. And this brought sound to the mass movie audience. The silent film afterwards quickly died. Ethel Waters in Los Angeles on tour was spotted by the movie studios who were already aware of her. And Ethel Waters appeared in the 1929 film On With the Show. She just had two musical interludes in that movie. One of the songs that she sang was the song Am I Blue? This song became a huge hit. A few years later, in 1933, Ethel Waters appeared at the Cotton Club, the most glittering, biggest, grandest club in New York City. A club that specialized in African-American entertainment, but a club that often blocked African-Americans from being in the audience. In 1933, Ethel Waters introduced at the Cotton Club, with Duke Ellington backing her, a song called Stormy Weather. Stormy Weather had a tremendous impact. Everyone in New York was talking about it. Shortly after the review opened at the Cotton Club, who showed up to hear Ethel Waters but the great composer Irving Berlin? Irving Berlin afterwards met with Ethel Waters. He was doing a new show called As Thousands Cheer that would open in 1933. It was a white show with white stars, and he wanted Ethel Waters in it. Ethel Waters agreed to do the show, and interestingly enough, that in the show, the white stars, Clifton Webb and Marilyn Miller and Helen Broderick, their names were all above the title. Ethel Waters' name was not, even though she was very famous at this point. Ethel Waters said, okay, I'll do it. A friend of Ethel Waters told me that one of Ethel Waters' favorite expressions was, I'll show the bitches. She knew that Irving Berlin had given her great material. One of the songs that she sang was Heat Wave, a very sexy number. We're having a heat wave. Another was a song called Harlem on My Mind, in which she got to parody Josephine Baker. And then there was a song called Supper Time. Supper Time, within the context of the show, told the story of a black woman who was preparing dinner for her family. She knows, though, that her husband is not coming home because her husband has been lynched. This song, For His Thousands Cheer, it was a very unusual piece of music. And Irving Berlin and Moss Hart, who created the show, weren't sure if audiences were going to accept Supper Time. It was much too serious. It had this strong racial, social context. They decided they would see how the song went on tryouts. And a tryout city for His Thousands Cheer was right here in Philadelphia. And Ethel Waters, when she sang Supper Time, again, the audience was mesmerized and turned silent. Now, this is a few years before Billie Holiday would do her song Strange Fruit, which was much more explicit in terms of its racial social content. But Ethel Waters had done it in this Broadway-bound musical, and then when the show got to Broadway, Berlin said it had to stay in, and it ended up being, of course, probably the centerpiece of that review. Ethel Waters, the woman with the name below the title, ended up being the real star of the show. Afterwards, 2 years later, she went back to Broadway in another show called At Home Abroad, another white musical. This time, her name was above the title. That show was a success. Ethel Waters continued to make recordings. She continued to tour. But she was a very, very ambitious, driven woman. Ethel knew that as much as she liked Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey, she hadn't done in music what they had. She hadn't gone to the gut. Ethel Waters felt she could do it by playing dramatic roles. In 1939, Ethel Waters opened on Broadway in a dramatic show dealing with three generations of African-American women, a show called Mamba's Daughters. Now, the night that that show opened, the stories still circulate in theater history today. The audience was full of skeptics and cynics. Who did this sort of blues singer think she was, that she could come here and give a dramatic performance? Broadway at this time, as far as dramatic roles were concerned, it was the domain of Catherine Cornell, Ethel Barrymore, Helen Hayes. No black woman had really gotten to that point on Broadway in really a magnificent dramatic performance. Ethel Waters that night came on stage and she proved all the cynics and skeptics wrong. She gave such a powerhouse performance that that night it was said that she received 17 curtain calls. And for Ethel Waters, the importance of Mamba's daughter and the character she played, Hager, was that Ethel Waters always felt that character was close to her mother, Louise. Hager was a half-crazed figure who loved a daughter. And Ethel Waters felt she might be able to tell her mother's story and maybe be able to reach her mother by playing this role. It was a tremendous success. The critics raved, except for one. Brooks Atkinson, the all-powerful critic at the New York Times, didn't like Ethel Waters' performance and was critical. After his review appeared, a group of theater artists, including Tallulah Bankhead, said that something had to be done because Brooks Atkinson, the Times critic, was wrong. They took an ad out in the Times praising Ethel Waters. Brooks Atkinson went back to see the play again and wrote a new review in which he celebrated Waters. This was really just about unprecedented. Ethel Waters later the next year went to Broadway, and she did the Broadway musical Cabin in the Sky. Now, with all of this success, the question we have to ask is, what was Ethel like offstage? What was her life like? Offstage, Ethel Waters was a holy terror. Nobody would mess with her. There are all the stories of her feuds and her fights with different people. She was often on the defensive. Remember, as a girl, she had to claim her turf in Chester and Philadelphia. And she went through her whole life often feeling she had to do that. I interviewed Maud Russell, a woman who was Ethel Waters' understudy in the Thousands Cheer. And I said to Maud Russell, well, Ethel was very religious, right? She said, yes, she was religious. But that didn't stop her from putting the Bible down, cussing you out, and then going back and picking the Bible back up. Ethel fought with just about everyone. And in theater circles, the feuds were well known. At one time when Ethel Waters was appearing at the Plantation Club in the 1920s, Ethel was the headliner. And there was a young dancer making something of a name for herself. That young dancer watched Ethel during rehearsals and watched her during performance, studying her. One night, Ethel Waters came down with laryngitis. The young woman asked management to let her go on. They did. And she was a hit. And her name was Josephine Baker. Josephine said that Ethel got well mighty quick. As soon as she heard about La Baker on that stage, Ethel came back, and again, Josephine Baker said she laid down the law to her. Baker never tangled with her again. Ethel Waters also fought with Bill Bojangles Robinson. Some of you may remember him from the Shirley Temple movies. He teaches Shirley how to tap dance up the staircase. Bojangles came to detest Ethel Waters, so much so that he trained his dog to growl whenever Ethel might be around. Ethel Waters also fought with Billie Holiday. She was really hard on young female singers. She was the queen, and no one was going to take her throne. Billie Holiday told the story the time that she came here to Philadelphia and was hoping to be in the show that Ethel Waters was headlining on. Billie Holiday, during her audition, sang the song Underneath the Harlem Moon. It was Ethel's song. She said, suddenly in the darkness, a woman appeared saying, who the hell is this bitch singing my song? Billie Holiday said that she was fired, and she never really forgave Ethel Waters. In many respects, Ethel Waters had been an influence on Billie Holiday. Billie Holiday said her great influences were Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong. She could never bring herself, really, to say that Ethel indeed had influenced her. Ethel Waters, otherwise, offstage, she had a very, very turbulent love life. Ethel Waters had all sorts of relationships. She had same-sex relationships with women. She was religious, but her God understood what she wanted and accepted it. A woman I interviewed in California who had known Ethel in later years, the woman was much younger, they were simply friends, they were a platonic relationship. She said that Ethel Waters told her, almost boasting, that yes, she had once been a lesbian and that she was the best that had ever done it. But Ethel Waters also had a number of very serious relationships with men. One of her first significant relationships after that early marriage was with a black producer named Earl Dancer. Ethel Waters let it be known that the two of them were married. They really weren't. She later dumped him, and then she wanted to know how anybody ever had the idea that they were married, when, of course, she had led them to believe this herself. She also had a relationship with a man named Clyde Eddie Matthews, who traveled to Europe with her. She said he was a husband. And then she had a relationship with the musician Eddie Mallory. Ethel Waters, no doubt, her great love was Eddie Mallory, this musician. He was sometimes called Pretty Eddie. Ethel Waters was making a fortune. She bought an apartment building in Harlem. There was a whole floor dedicated for just Eddie and herself. And she lived in high style. Money came in, money went out. When her relationship with Eddie Mallory turned sour, this affected Waters deeply. And Waters then was on the run. She was touring. She went back to Los Angeles. By now, she no longer was Sweet Mama String Bean. Ethel Waters was getting heavy. And later in her career, she would weigh over 300 pounds. Ethel Waters, nonetheless, when she got back to Los Angeles, what did she decide she wanted to do? She decided she wanted now to really make movies. Well, when we look at this, we wonder how could she have thought this? There were so few roles for African-American women, and the African-American women who got a chance at playing, and there weren't many, glamorous or leading roles, almost always they were mulatto types. They were lighter, with the straight hair, the keen features. There was no real place for older, heavier, browner black women to be glamorized in Hollywood. They ended up often playing the mammy figures. Nonetheless, Ethel Waters decided she was going to make movies. She did some, in which she did play a maid. And then MGM decided to do Cabin in the Sky, which had been that Broadway show. This was the first black film that Hollywood had done since 1935. As I said, it was an all-star cast, and Ethel Waters headed that cast. Now, Cabin became difficult for Ethel. It was difficult for many reasons. She didn't like the way religion was depicted in the movie. But mainly, she didn't like Lena Horne. Lena Horne was younger, she was slimmer, she was lighter, she was indeed a beautiful woman. Ethel Waters felt that Lena Horne was getting preferential treatment from the studio. And Ethel Waters raised Cain. Everyone I talked to who worked on Cabin in the Sky, they said it was unbelievable the way she treated poor Lena. Lena could do nothing right, and that sequence that we saw earlier, no doubt, was her favorite scene with Lena. Actually, she didn't want to have to do any scenes with her, but in that scene, she got to speak her mind. Ethel Waters was so difficult on this film that afterwards she said she was blacklisted in Hollywood and didn't get work in movies for 6 years. Those 6 years were difficult years for Ethel Waters. There was no movie work. There were some theater appearances, but nothing big was happening in her career. She also started having health problems, and many people were saying that Ethel Waters was finished. She had been the most famous African-American woman in popular entertainment thus far in the 20th century, and they were saying that Ethel Waters' day had come and gone. She had problems with the IRS. She didn't know how she was going to make it. And then Ethel Waters was offered the chance to test for a supporting role in a movie called Pinky. And Pinky told the story of a light-skinned young black woman who decides to pass for white. When she makes that decision, she breaks her grandmother's heart, and Ethel was testing for the part of the grandmother. She got the role. What's very interesting is that the original director on Pinky was John Ford, a major American film director. The two of them clashed, and the movie's producer, Darrell F. Zanuck, took John Ford off the picture and brought in Aaliyah Kazan. Kazan would later direct A Streetcar Named Desire. He would also direct On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando. Kazan worked with Ethel Waters, and he said the main thing that Ethel needed was to be treated as if she was intelligent, which indeed she was. Now, if you see Pinky, it is this sort of long-suffering, mammy-like character, distinguished, though, by Ethel Waters' great warmth and sense of humanity. She was nominated for the Academy Award as Best Supporting Actress in 1949. No black woman, no black performer had been nominated since Hattie McDaniel had won in 1939 for Gone with the Wind. Ethel Waters got the nomination. She did not win. And then she got an offer to do a play on Broadway, an adaptation of Carson McCullough's The Member of the Wedding. Ethel Waters objected to the play. She said there was no God in it, and there was no way she would do it unless there were changes. She also told the producer, "I may be down and out right now, but I'm not that down. And I'm not that out." She eventually got the changes. The Member of the Wedding, again, they were unsure how this play would work on Broadway. Again, it too came to Philadelphia, and Philadelphia audiences praised her. It went to Broadway. It was a huge hit. Later, she did the movie version. She also starred in a TV series called Beulah in 1950. Her career was back on track, but not for long. Ethel Waters found herself plagued now by health problems. She had hypertension, congestive heart failure eventually, diabetes. Again, she had money problems. The whole thing with the IRS. Ethel Waters didn't know what was going to happen with her. The career went into another kind of decline, and then Ethel Waters ended up performing with Billy Graham's Crusades, the religious crusades that went around the country. And Ethel Waters was able to reach large audiences there. Interesting with Ethel Waters, she did keep working, though, in television and in movies for years to come without the great parts, but she worked nonetheless. The other thing about Ethel Waters, when she was performing with Billy Graham, very, very pious and very conservative, this woman who knew Ethel Waters told me that Waters, in those later years, when she was about 300 pounds, had quite a love affair with a man many years younger. I said to her, "Well, what did the Billy Graham people say about this?" She said to me, "Are you crazy?" Ethel wouldn't say a word to the Graham people about what she was doing. But Ethel always had a belief. Her God was a personal God. And her God understood her and would accept, if she went to him with a certain kind of humility, the things that she did. Ethel Waters' later years were years, really, in which she was in very, very poor health and finally could not work. She was also forgotten in many ways, and a new generation didn't understand her at all. But that was Ethel Waters, this major figure of the 20th century, a woman who broke down barriers in the recording industry, on Broadway, in the movies, and in television. And a woman we really shouldn't forget. That's only part of the story. You can read the rest in Heat Wave, The Life and Career of Ethel Waters. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Take a few questions if any of you have any questions about her. I don't want to tell you too much because you got to get the book, right? There's a whole lot more in it. Yes.
Does she have any
No, she did not have any children. She did. There was a girl named Agretta, who she did informally adopt. Ethel Waters said that she had lost two children, but she did not have any children. At one time, when she was living in New York in the 1930s, Ethel Waters had a whole group of children she would bring into her apartment, and they would sometimes stay with her. Their parents would come as well. She fed them, bought them toys and everything. She did have this great desire to be a mother, but she said she never did give birth to any children. Yes.
What year did she die?
She died in 1977, and she died about a month short of what would have been her 80th birthday. And when she did die, what's very interesting is that she got front page coverage in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the papers here, and the Philadelphia Tribune, of course. Yes, Philadelphia Tribune.
I wanted to ask the question. You talked about all the people that she had feuds with. What about Dorothy Dandridge?
Well, no, she really didn't with Dorothy Dandridge. The interesting thing was, you know, when Lena Horne, by the way, the other thing I'll mention about Lena Horne, which Ethel, two things Ethel didn't like pertaining to Lena Horne. One, Lena Horne recorded Stormy Weather. And many people think that's Lena's song. It was Ethel's song, and Ethel never forgave her for that. One of the other things that happened with Lena Horne, Ethel Waters loved prize fights, and she would go to see Joe Louis, the big bouts with Joe Louis. And when she was working on Cabin in the Sky, she learned that Joe Louis had come to the set to see Lena Horne. And Ethel didn't like that. I should also tell you that Joe ended up, Lena got upset with Joe because at another time when Joe was in town in Los Angeles, he had gone to MGM, but he didn't see Lena at that point. Joe had gone to see Lana Turner. So Lena didn't like that either. But with Dorothy Dandridge, the reason I mentioned Lena is because Dorothy Dandridge, when she came up, Lena at that point had been the top black female entertainer, having done movies. And Dandridge comes in, who was younger, and in some ways seemed like she was replacing her. And Ethel did not seem to mind Dorothy Dandridge. And we want to remember Dorothy is younger and not really... Dorothy was appearing in nightclubs, but in the 50s. But at that point, Ethel really was not so much a nightclub fixture anymore. Eartha Kitt did have an encounter with her. I should also say there were people who liked Ethel Waters. Leslie Uggams, who I interviewed, knew Ethel Waters when she was a girl. She liked her very much. Leslie Uggams appeared on that show, Beulah, and felt that she was very, very kind. And there were other people who did gravitate to her and who she seemed to be more relaxed with. But no, she didn't give Dorothy Dandridge any problems. No.
Were you able to interview any of her relatives in Chester?
No, I did not. What happened, I was trying to find the relatives, and then at one point I really began to think, you know, again, she was born in 1996, and for me, just to find her contemporaries, people who actually knew her up close and everything, who could give me some kind of personal input, those people were really gone. Where I was lucky was that some of those people I had interviewed earlier for other books, and they had spoken of Ethel Waters, and so I used some of their comments. One of the people was, I don't know if you're familiar with the actress Freddie Washington, but Freddie Washington, if you see the original 1934 version of Imitation of Life, and I urge you to see that version, she played the light-skinned young black woman who passes for white. And Freddie Washington and Ethel did indeed get along, and I had interviewed, they got along basically, and I had interviewed Freddie, but no, in the end, I did not end up talking to relatives in Chester. Yeah.
My mother and her older sister had relationships and played with the Anderson children, the Marion Anderson siblings, and they also knew Ethel Waters, and she worked at Horn and Hardart for 40 years with them. Is there any connection between the Anderson family and the Waters family, Ethel Waters?
You mean Marion Anderson's family?
Marion Anderson's family.
Yeah, because Marion Anderson, you know, is from Philadelphia. No, I came across no connection.
Okay, because you mentioned Anderson.
Yes, it was Anderson. Mm-hmm. It was Anderson. Actually, the grandmother's maiden name was Sally's name was Sarah Harris, and she married a man who was called Honey Anderson. But what I came across, he was not from Philadelphia. They came to you know, the Philadelphia area and settled here. But I didn't come across any connection there with the great Marion Anderson. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Do you have any knowledge of how big a range she had? Was she a soprano?
You know, she had a pretty she had a good range in that, you know, at one point she did a classical piece with the music of Rachmaninoff. And I came across something where she explored sort of opera. I don't know if any of you saw Aretha Franklin some years ago on the Grammys when she did an operatic aria. And Ethel did, I mean, Ethel was very, very adventurous, I mean, and was always testing herself. So she did have this range, and she did other things. There was also the great Hebrew lament, Eli, Eli, which Ethel Waters performed, and I came across accounts of people who heard her perform that, and they said there was nothing, you know, they had just heard nothing like it. But she was a, you know, she was just this all-around talent that we don't see much of today. There are people like that who come once in a century who can do sort of everything. Sammy Davis Jr. was sort of like that. These are just great entertainers. And I would also say, ironically, people don't realize it, but Diana Ross was like that as well. Diana Ross was a great entertainer live. She's very good in the movie Lady Sings the Blues. But Ethel really, and at the start of that as the 20th century was going on, she was the one that set the bar for all of that. And she did indeed have this great, great range. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I thought she did a very good job on I Got Rhythm by Gershwin in 1930, which seems like a pretty swinging song, even about 5 years ahead of the swing era.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see her, Billie Holiday, picking up any phrasing out of something like Stormy Weather?
Well, you know, Billie Holiday, in one of her early recordings, I think it is in 1933, it's one of the early ones. Your son's mother-in-law or something like that. There you can get some of the phrasing of Ethel. And it was interesting that the producer, George Ween, who knew Billy and who knew Ethel as well, and he was the one who really said that Ethel had indeed, he felt, he was just convinced that she was this great influence on Billy. And Billy in the early part, because Billy's music changes as she goes along and becomes, in a sense, more experimental. I mentioned Ella Fitzgerald. She also influenced, if you ever hear some of Pearl Bailey's recordings, Ethel sometimes talked as much as she sang. And she had the double entendre, where she would bring the sex in. If you hear Pearl Bailey on something like Takes Two to Tango, the old song where she talks as she sings. Bing Crosby was an admirer of Ethel Waters. He also later did a recording of Dinah, Frank Sinatra, Mildred Bailey. I mean, she was really the one that they all just looked to. And it really was that diction. And then again, the ability to tell a story in song. Another song that she did that Mabel Mercer later recorded, and others did, Ella Fitzgerald as well, is Miss Otis Regrets. Oh, yeah. And if you ever hear that and you hear the others, they clearly have been influenced by Ethel. But there are few people who really can tell that kind of story in song the way that she did. And the thing was that in music, in a sense, before she really starts to act, she's acting out in these songs with her dramatic pauses that she'll have. Yes.
In Tales of Manhattan, Paul Robeson and Ethel Ward got criticized for playing that role of sharecroppers.
Mm-hmm.
I think later Paul Robeson denounced it, but did Ethel Ward have any opinion?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Paul Robeson did denounce it. They played, it was, Tales of Manhattan was an all-star film done, was White Stars, basically, done in the, Rita Hayworth's in it, Charles Boyer, Charles Lawton, and it was done in the early 40s, and it concludes with a black segment with Robeson, Eddie Rochester Anderson, Ethel Waters, and there is a tailcoat that's dropped from an airplane. It's got all this money in it, and they're very naive the way they're depicted, and they think this is a gift from God and so forth. And there were protests first in Los Angeles against it, and then in New York. And we want to remember this, we're in the 40s now, the Second World War has started, and movie images for African Americans are now being questioned with the war. And these comic servants that, often dimwitted, the actors and actresses were very talented, but they didn't write their roles. And often they had to play against character rather than playing character. But nonetheless, there was criticism of the film. Robeson ended up denouncing it and said he wouldn't appear in another movie, and he didn't play another movie role. He did a narration for a film, but he didn't do another role after that. Ethel Waters, and this is one of the things that happened to her, she was sort of jarred by the criticism, and she didn't understand, because the criticism was coming from the African-American community, and she didn't understand how black people could criticize her. I mean, she knew how hard it had been to get the career she had, and she felt that she should have been supported. Now, if she had stepped back and sort of looked at the movie objectively, it would have been different, but that she could not do. And this is one of the other things that happened to her as time went on, was that Ethel Waters, you know, when America changed in the 50s with the rise of the civil rights movement, and then when the civil rights movement evolved into the black power movement, Ethel Waters, at one point, she said she was not a member of the NAACP, couldn't do anything for her. And what's interesting is that, ironically, in the 30s, she was a real race woman. She had really, she had gone to fundraisers, participated in fundraisers for the NAACP, the Defense Fund. But as time went on, I think she was a bit bewildered by the changes coming about in black America, and she was very sensitive to the criticism of some of these the roles. Tales of Manhattan in particular. Pinky also, Walter White, the executive secretary of the NAACP, he did not criticize Ethel Waters' performance, but he criticized the way the character was written. And I think that's really when Ethel Waters, she began to change, had a change in feelings towards the NAACP. And then later with Ethel Waters, which I'm not going to say much more because you're going to read about it in the book, right? They tell me not to say too much. But the other thing that happened to Ethel Waters later, she did become politically, in a sense, more conservative. And then in the 70s, there was a lot, early 70s, she went to Richard Nixon's White House. And she had performed at a prayer service there. I should also mention Sammy Davis Jr. was seen at the White House with Nixon and Pearl Bailey. And a new generation, I'm talking now of African Americans, really just did not like this. And later she showed up and she at Trisha Nixon's wedding in the White House. And this was another thing that I think really hurt her, that a new generation coming in and feeling that politically she was out of tune, out of whack with what was happening, and that generation not being aware that at an earlier time she'd really been rather active. And I should say this, that Ethel Waters' attitudes in the 70s, there were other African-Americans at that time, older African-Americans, who didn't like some of the changes coming about for whatever reasons. Ethel Waters did not like use of the word black. And there was a generation of African Americans, her generation, which felt the same way, that black was a term that had been used when they were growing up in the worst way, and they never really accepted it. So she was in a kind of, in some ways, a time warp, and I think that did hurt her. I'll take one more. Yes.
Watching the clip from Tim Stein and listening to you speak and some of the ways you've answered actually really have a career of longevity in one or the other? Where do you think?
Well, she really wanted to act. And the problem is where her, when we look at her music career, she wasn't burdened with the problems that she did in the acting career. I mean, this whole thing of typing. Now, sometimes in the music career, the sexuality, some of the thing. I mean, as I said, she didn't like that. But I think that works because she. I don't see that as so much a stereotype of an African American woman because she's so much in control. She's in control in her sound and in her attitude. But as an actress, I mean, if you see her in The Member of the Wedding, it is still a very powerful performance. I mean, in The Member of the Wedding, she is a cook in a white household, and she really cares for these two white children. And she is nurturing and comforting, but she also shows her anger in that film. And there's also a great sequence in that when the director, Fred Zinnemann, he comes up for really a terrific close-up of Waters, when Waters is talking about her love life and the man that she loved and that she lost. So she's really not, she's not completely de-sexed in Member of the Wedding, that there is a comment on her sexuality and on her love life. To answer your question, it would be hard to say. I think she was a terrific actress, and I just would have liked to have seen her had more opportunities to do it. And the other thing about her as an actress, and it was a great gift, and with discussions of Mammy-like figures aside, she always had this tremendous warmth. And she really, there was this kind of humanity that comes in some of her dramatic performances. And if that could have been in a series of other roles that you know, were well written and so forth, I think we'd have quite a bit to look at with her. I should also tell you that she later did The Sound and the Fury, an adaptation of William Faulkner's novel with Yul Brynner and Joanne Woodward in the late 50s. And that's not a very good film. But the funny thing about it, when you see it, the movie really, the early sections have Ethel Waters, and she is the one you're watching, because the movie is just so ineptly written that Joanne Woodward and Yul Brynner don't always know what they're doing, but Ethel Waters does. And there's one sequence in that I really like, that she has to run, up from this cabin up to the big house, and it's a very girlish run. And Ethel Waters, you know, maybe sexuality is in the eye of the beholder. She thinks she's still kind of hot. And you're going with her. And it's very nice to see a older, heavier black woman who does this. There's also, there was a TV series, Route 66, and there's an episode in that, Goodnight Sweet Blues, where she plays a dying blues singer. And she was nominated for the Emmy for that. And one of the things that came across that I found amusing, when she met with the producers of it, she said that they thought she was going to be like an old bag coming in to see them. And she came in, and she said that she knew they were surprised that, you know, she still had this vitality and even sex appeal. Well, again, it's funny that 300 pounds and she sees herself as still having sex appeal, and I think we go along with her in that way. So it's a wonderful thing when someone can make us see them through their eyes and what, you know, what it is that they have to offer. But I think she was a very talented actress. I just would have liked to have seen her be able to do more. She probably was able to do more with the music than with acting roles. That's it. Thank you all very much. Good night.
Thank you all. Give us a few minutes to get up there, and then we'll have a book signing. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.